for war, never back down, give me some more. We came for the title, killing the game. Welcome into another episode of Patrick Jones Baseball. Hope you're doing well wherever you're listening at. On this week's episode, we have Mike Brown. Mike is the recruiting coordinator at the University of Utah. He's got a great story, great background, and shares his own recruiting story of being in high school, and then he went to a junior college and then ended up getting a scholarship to go play in the SEC. So he shares that, which is really cool. And then he talks a lot about, you know, what he's looking for as a recruiting coordinator at the Power 5 level. Some of the things that are objective that, you know, everybody can see, and then some of the things that are subjective, the intangibles as well. So, and then lastly, we also get into, you know, the University of Utah and what their own philosophies are from an offensive standpoint. So it's great stuff. Mike's an awesome guy, so appreciate him for coming on the podcast. One of the things that I have been doing for several years now and continuing to do right now is work with players and help them in the recruiting process. So if you're a high school player, if you're a junior college player, feel free to reach out to me. I am currently working with players one-on-one to help them in the recruiting process. So you can check out my website, patrickjonesbaseball.com/recruiting, to learn more. So patrickjonesbaseball.com/recruiting. And check out everything I have going on in the recruiting side of my business right there. All right, here we go with Mike Brown. This is the future. This is my time. I grind and shine. I put in the work and push the line. I'm holding my crown. I never back down. All right, we now welcome onto the podcast Mike Brown. Mike, thanks for coming on the show today.
Patrick, thanks for having me.
Awesome, man. It's been a long time in the making. I know.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's only been 6 or 8 months in the making.
I know. I'm glad we got to finally have you on. But I know you've been crazy busy, and, you know, with the start of the season, and you're still recruiting and helping out with your team and everything like that. You know, I kind of want to jump off the rails here and ask you a question that I know you'll know because you've been – One, you're the recruiting coordinator, and then two, you've been around college baseball several different locations. But I think it would be interesting for people to kind of understand, because you get 11.7 scholarships. Normally, how are those numbers dished out across positions, right? Is it percentages where, like, hey, up the middle's 3.3 full scholarships, and then center, you know, like, how does it work exactly? Yeah. Where the money is spread apart?
Great question. And I think we're all very specific and very detailed on paper, you know what I mean? But sometimes the best player available becomes the best player available, and you kind of got to get them for whatever the cost is. But I would say, Patrick, I mean, our goal is to spend like 6 on arms and 5-7 on position players, you know, in kind of a perfect world. I think the balance and the years kind of change, especially nowadays when maybe multiple year deals are executed a little bit more commonly than they were. But I mean, I think the balance has got to favor pitching when it's all said and done. But I also think we try to spend our money up the middle, like you kind of referenced. I think catching is the starting catcher is going to be on a decent scholarship. I think weekend starters are going to be on a bigger scholarship than the bullpen guy, or, you know, the aspirations for the middle of the pack arm, shortstops and center fielders. You know, I think on our team, without getting specific, but we have paid those premier positions. And I think it's helping us, you know, but our mission is to get the best player available, man. Sometimes the biggest impact guy could be a third baseman, or could be a back end bullpen guy. And I think, you know, I think that's where the dialogue and the camaraderie of a coaching staff in general, hey man, are we good to make this move on a guy who's not the fastest leadoff shortstop, you know, kind of prototypical middle guy. And so it's just a fun formula, and it changes every year. And I think, you know, I think available money changes it a little bit, you know, in terms of your budget or how much you have left to spend. But to answer your question and not ramble, I think shortstops, catchers, center fielders, weekend starters are kind of what you want to build your team around financially.
Do I assume JUCO players and players out of the portal would get more money just because they're more established?
Well, yeah, I think in a perfect world, for sure. And I think the JUCO player, you can kind of formulate, he's going to plug and chug now. You know, like, we got a junior college shortstop, and he had to earn it, and he had to beat a couple guys out. But, like, looking at our roster on paper, if he came in and did what he was capable of doing, it was going to be his job. And we felt a lot more comfortable about that, a spiel, if you want to call it, in the recruiting process than a high school kid. Just simply because it's a different environment, it's a different deal. The JUCO kid that I'm referencing had already played Division One baseball, so the stage or the moment wouldn't potentially be too big. Still could be, which is another beauty of the recruiting process. But unfortunately for us, it hasn't been, and he's done an unbelievable job. And if we you go look back and all the money and all the negotiations, like we'd pay him double what we paid him, which would be more than a one, but you know what I'm saying? Like the cost is irrelevant once the bullets start flying. I feel like, because every roster's got some guys that you're paying more than necessarily they're earning, I think.
And is it normal for, let's say you bring a guy on as a walk-on, he plays really well. Like he really just surpasses all your expectations. And is it normal to put that guy on a scholarship for year two, or is it
Yeah, I
just,
think.
yeah?
No, I think so. Since I've been here at Utah, this is my third cycle, third season. We've added guys that weren't on money to money both years. I maybe not normal, Patrick, you know what I mean? But I think two things. I think that can be discussed in the recruiting process. Like, hey, man, there is an opportunity to get money. We try to dictate or kind of formulate the scholarships based on the need of the family, maybe more so than anything. There are kids that, fortunately for them and their families, they don't need as much money as some other kids. Maybe they don't need any money. Maybe they have a government, grant that pays for their tuition or something. So like I think, talking to a kid, we get him to walk on, it's tough for his family financially. Those conversations about potential money are way more common than it would be from a kid who, hey coach, I'm good as a walk-on, like I just want an opportunity. I think you have the earning of a scholarship conversations less with that family than the family that, could really, really benefit it and quite frankly, maybe need it going forward.
You had mentioned about, hey, Division One baseball, like is he ready for this stage, right? With everything that comes with playing high level Division One baseball. How do you go about really knowing that if you're out there recruiting a high school player?
I mean, you don't, I don't think there's a perfect, I don't think any recruiter, and I think we all miss. You know what I mean? You think you know about a player, you feel really comfortable and confident, and then he shows up and he's not the player that you sort of rehearsed or thought about it that would come to fruition. But I do think as you watch more guys, I mean, you watch them a lot. You watch their interactions with their teammates. You watch the biggest challenge I think high school kids face is some of them don't fail that much. We have a kid from a small town in Wyoming who, he played on the travel circuit and played in all the big events, but like the continual failure was really minimal for him in his life. He's very talented, plays both sides of the baseball. And so him getting to a Division One where everybody's a little older and better and the competition is more fierce and all that, that's a big challenge. And he's doing a great job of overcoming the failures, but that's the unknown, I think, Patrick. So I think if you can uncover that as a recruiter, the most you can, how he responds, how he shows up to the yard on a day-to-day basis, which obviously the coaches, I think, influence us a ton. But that's the best, recipe for trying to figure it out. And so, baseball is baseball. So if a kid's really, really good and, he's better than some of your current guys on your club now who are playing at the college level, that influences it, I think, to some degree,
People are always interested to know like what exactly college coaches are looking for, and that's such a, I mean, generic question, right? Because it's like, well, what level are we talking about? You know what I mean? Like, is it Power Five? Is it Division One? Is it Division Two? But what my question to you is it seems that maybe 10, 15 years ago, and correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like projection, like, well, the kid's pretty raw right now, but he's got a good body. He's a really good athlete. Like, we could see him filling out potentially, and you may take a gamble on that kid, where it seems like now you have to be more ready right away. And maybe it doesn't matter as much that, there's, upside here. How much upside's there here? It's like, how good is he right now? Is that accurate in your opinion?
Well, I definitely think it's more accurate than it used to be, with the limitations on rosters, which the limitations on scholarships and walk-on players, and more time, quite frankly, right? You didn't have the portal. Junior college baseball was maybe a little less booming at the time, and but I do think there's still some of that. I think there has to be, and I think every program's a little bit different. And for us, like if we take kind of a flyer, right, kind of describe, hey man, this guy can really, really run. The hit tool hasn't translated yet, but he's athletic. All I just think it becomes the personality of the kid. You know what I mean? And how does that kid get over failure? Like one thing that's really challenging, I think, for me at least, to uncover is aptitude. Like, does the kid get better? Like, can the kid be told a couple different cues and execute those cues? You know, or if he makes improvements on Monday and Tuesday, like, can he maintain them and build off of them into the weekend and into next week? Or does he simply forget and show up the next day, and now you're talking about the exact same swing adjustment that you were talking about the day before. And so again, I think that comes with knowing the coaches that they're working with and kind of building trust with those guys and saying, hey man, he gets better. You know, he's raw, he's new, he's got some outstanding skill, whether it be run or potential for power. You know, so I don't think it's that black and white. And I think that'll be a consistent message for me, Patrick. Like the recruiting is so, you know, it's human based. You know what I mean? So it's everyone asks that question, and I think the answer is, man, it just depends on who the kid is. You know what I mean? If the kid's talented and he's eager to get better and he's passionate about baseball and, you know, he's a late bloomer, as we talked about off the show, like, okay, if you feel good about it, you like the kid, I would go on that kid way more than a kid who's doesn't have those other attributes, along with being a sort of a flyer and raw, and you know what I'm saying?
On average, how many times will you watch a high school kid before you offer him?
It's a great question. I mean, I think multiple times, and in this day and age, that is getting shrunken and shrunken. But I also think we as a staff, like we all want to see him. You know what I mean? So like once I see him, I feel good about it. I'm confident in kind of the evaluation, and then I'll send Gwill, or I'll you know try to figure out a way to get Gwill over there, or Troy, or Squires, or Coach Henderson, and then they can get their unbiased their eyes on him. And once we get multiple evaluations from, you know, maybe my end, or Gwill sees him 2 or 3 times and then I go watch him one time and hey man, I'm on that. I like it. That makes things a little bit simpler for us. But if it's a fringy guy, I mean, the more you watch him, the more the answer is probably no. You know what I'm saying? I mean, in the high school level, like we're trying to go out there and baseball is so challenging because you can't take over every game. But we want to go out and watch guys square balls up or throw a bunch of strikes or you know impact the game in a one eval setting, and that's not always possible in our sport, as you know.
100%. Yeah. What advice would you give Mike Brown 5 years ago with everything you know now from a recruiter standpoint?
Well, get to know the kid and the people he surrounds himself with more. You know, like I feel like, and maybe this is a bad attribute, but you know, I'm a little less naive. So I talked to a kid one time. He just says all the right things. He's got, you know, smart people in his corner telling him what to say, or maybe mom and dad are over the shoulder. And boom, I've, you know, could fall into a trap of thinking that kid is exactly who that kid is, instead of he's talking to a college baseball coach and it's a recruiting call, and you know, there's a little extra polish. But at the same token, I mean, I think, and I'm always trying to learn and trying to get better. And I remember learning from Joel Mangrum, who was a guy that I worked with in New Mexico State, but the best recruiter I've ever been around. But it's like, man, just get to know the kid. Like if you like the kid, that helps the process, that helps the cause, and really try to do a good job of uncovering who that kid is. Baseball player, yes. But just as a person and as a junior in high school or a sophomore in junior college or whatever it is, like try to find out what he's about. Because selfishly, I do think that influences the performance and how they go about their business once they get to us, inevitably.
Why do you think that Coach was one of the best recruiters you've ever seen?
Well, I think hard work is a very cliche answer, but man, it was very specific communication at its highest level. Like, so when I say, I mean, we all work long hours and all that, but it was, he's going to talk to kids till midnight every night. And the time associated with the work ethic, I think, was one of the better attributes that it was the best thing for me ever, because I just thought it was normal. You know, and okay, this is how all recruiters are, and you know, I get it. And now I understood why a lot of coaches that mentored me kind of as a player and getting as a young coach told me not to be a coach. It made a lot of sense in
Told
terms
you
of who
not to be a
I am.
coach?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common deal. You get done playing, you want to coach, and John Cohen is a mentor of mine who was my coach, is, you know, hey, you got to be an idiot. And they're just testing you. And then if you don't, you know, you weren't cut out for it. But there's time is the biggest challenge I think all coaches face, not having enough of it. And it being occupied by juniors in high school or sophomores in junior college. But Joel just taught me that, like, and you got to divvy up your time so you have time for your family and all that. But I mean, communicating, if you weren't touching a kid 3 times a week, you were kind of blowing it. There was constant contact.
Wow, three
And so
times a
anyway,
week.
that I guess, and amongst other things, he's a great guy, but I just remember, like, we're making 10 calls a night at New Mexico State. Like, it was relentless. So it was good. It was the best thing that could happen to me as a young coach.
Yeah, man, that's really interesting. And I know that it's interesting too from a recruiting standpoint is, when you're watching players, there's the subjective and the objective, right? The objective's obviously they're home to first time and they're 60 time and how hard they throw. The subjective is it's subjective, right? But and I think that's what maybe frustrates, I think, at times, like even parents and players, like, well, honestly, he just doesn't really look the part. You know what I mean? And sometimes that hurts you. And it's like there's nothing you can really do about that. You know what I mean? Is there
Yes.
anything from like that you find yourself consistently going to that's subjective, but it's like, man, like I believe this. If I see this, like I'm intrigued.
Well, I think engagement, man. I mean, the more that I watch, especially on the travel circuit and kind of the bigger tournaments, when the kid's only engaged in his own act, his own at bats, his own performance, and there's like a shell in terms of his teammates, and they're all new teammates, so I do get it. But I guess maybe a better answer, more positive answer, is the kid who's engaged with everybody, and he's motoring around, and he's kind of looking to see what's going on, evaluating the game. Like, that's the kid that attracts me, versus the kid who's in his own world. And yeah, it's a new team and it's a new experience in terms of all the kids having the same one, but nobody knows each other that well. How do you put yourself out there? Because when you get to college baseball, you are forced to be uncomfortable, and be in sort of in your own way or tied up in your own thoughts or whatever, your own failures or successes. It doesn't work big picture on a college team, and it doesn't work on a high school team, and it doesn't work on a team that meets all the time. You know what I mean? So I think, the best way to separate yourself, or one of the things that I'm watching for, is what are you doing in the times that you're not hitting, you're not running to first, you're not in the games even playing. You know what I'm saying? What are you bringing to the table other than those objective things that you mentioned?
So you'll set yourself up when you're at the game you're at to see like what they're doing in the dugout.
Yeah, 100%. How they respond after an out, how they respond after a bad call. And I do think, like, the kids are trained on this. Do you know what I mean? Like, we have camps, and I give this, same rundown every time. Hey, man, you're going to make an error. I want to watch what happens after you make the error. And then we have camp. And then they make an error, and they're pissed off, and their body language goes, sours. And, like, it's so funny because the game is so challenging in that way. You know what I mean? And really, we talk about it with our players every single day. Like, our objective as coaches is to teach them how to play one pitch at a time, like in its purest form. The last pitch is gone. The next pitch doesn't matter. The only thing that matters in your life is that 20 seconds in that pitch. And it's a constant, ongoing battle. You know what I'm saying? So I think it's ironic and funny at the same time. Like, I tell kids, hey, man, I don't care how you perform. I want to watch how you respond. And they're like, oh, and then they pop out and they don't run and they're pissed off. And I'm like, dude, I already told you. I don't care about the what's cool is when you hit a pop up, to the infield and you're busting your ass to second base, and like you hit a line drive in the gap. I think that is way we're all gonna miss, we're gonna miss underneath the ball, we're gonna shank a ball, we're gonna spin off a ball. That's part of the deal. How you respond, I think, is what the separator becomes. And you got to be good, Patrick. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can't just spoon balls and hustle your tail off. But no, being confident in the evaluation. Okay, this guy could play for us. His skills as a baseball player could play for us. Now, can his personality and can his makeup and his determination, can he stick? And I think that becomes the next phase. And maybe a better answer for your question, that's kind of how I approached looking at the player now versus 5 years ago.
Gotcha. Yeah. I'm sure, the skills part of it, that's a lot easier to evaluate, right? Like picking a good athlete out, that's not necessarily that hard, but everything else that you just mentioned, like that's, really re recruiting and scouting, I should say. I want to ask you a little bit about infielders. And the only reason I want to ask for, well, I don't ask for a couple reasons. One, I've heard this from a couple other recruiters, and so I wasn't, I just wanted to get your take on it. One of the things that this one particular guy was telling me, this college coach, was when it comes to infielders, like arm action is very, was very important to him because he found that it was very hard to change. Like that was one of the things, very hard to change. Like when you're evaluating infielders, what are some of the things that you're specifically looking for? Like, is arm action that important to you? Does it not matter as much? Like, what's kind of your own theory?
Well, I think that's a great, and I would agree. I think arm action and specifically kind of a pushy arm stroke is really hard to correct. So, I mean, but what I'm looking for is accuracy, and I haven't seen too many, good movers, athletic shortstops that throw it with a pushy arm stroke and are accurate, But I also, as an infielder, man, I think since arm stroke wise, I think you got to be able to throw from different arm slots. I think you got to be able to throw left when you're moving right. I think that's a pretty important, or when you're moving left, be able to throw it right. And what I've grown really fond of, especially like in junior, watching junior college games and watching batting practice, like how many times does the ball come out of your glove in every aspect of the day? And I'll ask our guys, like, how many times did the ball fall out of your glove today? And the really good players, like, it doesn't come out of the glove very often, a couple times a day. And if you're taking mass ground balls, and I get it, but literally, does the ball stick in your glove? And I love it because in between inning ground balls, when they're half messing around and the first baseman's whipping it over there, and it bobbles, and I'm like, so you start to add those up, and then they might look clean in the four ground balls that they get in the at you glove side slow roller. But if you start watching, like I said, especially in a BP, man, they're getting 50, 60, 70 balls, even ones they're not like, does the live BP bullet come and he's not expecting it and he tries to stab it, does he catch it? Or does it constantly kick it out of the glove? So the more I see the ball fall out of the glove, the less I'm attracted to that infielder for sure. But I think throwing accuracy is key. I think motor is important. Like, does he come and get the baseball? Is there an anticipation to kind of close the distance and move? And then within that, can he create a little bit more space and grow a hop? Or how is the feel to read the ball off of the bat? I think becomes, something that the games show you way more than the five ground balls or the pregame infield outfield.
Yeah, I would assume that you would rather see a kid be a little bit more aggressive and go get that ball versus waiting back for it to come to him.
See, and I not as aggressive as the arm swing, but like if a kid is used to just kind of hanging back, that's a hard habit to break. You know what I mean? And
Yeah.
it takes time. And
It's more
I
that
think too,
passive mindset, yeah.
the passive mindset and like the I'm just gonna get a cherry hop because I'm just gonna no, like the hop is gonna get you if you want to hang back on everything. And the higher the level, the faster the hitter. And so all of a sudden, man, you may not have time. We have a couple hitters where if you hang back on a routine ground ball to the shortstop, he's safe.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I do think, and aggression's probably not the right word, but just like attack, like, can I go get the hop and can I catch it at my belt? Or if my read is a little bit too aggressive, can I slow down and kind of retreat and catch that thing on a long hop? And of course, all this is happening in a two or three step pattern,
I know you help out with the hitters at Utah and Todd Williams, who we've had on the podcast before. He's awesome and he's a great guy, great guy, great coach, but even better guy. What I'm sure he's involved when it comes to the recruiting, specifically for hitters. What are some of the things that maybe he's looking for, you're looking for when it comes to a hitting standpoint specifically? Are there very specific things he's looking for, or is it more so, again, going back to subjective?
Well, I think, man, consistent backspun line drives off the sweet spot of the bat is probably the biggest indicator that we talk about. Like, can he create backspin A in the world that we're kind of living in? The focus on backspinning baseballs all over the yard is a little less, I think, than it used to be. But if Gwill was on right now, I think he'd say, "Brownie, go get guys that drop head." Like, and can leverage the baseball and can hit for power, or at least have sort of the foundation to hit for power. And when I say that, like, do they have a strong barrel? Can they maintain their barrel? Can they lead with the barrel instead of, body swingers or knob knob leaders, which is a very challenging thing to correct. And in our league, man, if you don't know where the barrel is, like you're not gonna hit. You're gonna hit a lot of ground balls to the pull side and a lot of flares to the opposite field side. So I think when we watch hitters or when we get, I'm talking to a kid and he will evaluates the video or he goes out and sees a kid. I just think like, is the ball flight pretty true? And one thing Will has taught me, one of a million things, but like if they're hitting line drive, the line drive to the backside of the field should be relatively low, right? Because we'll talk if we talk more about, but we're in a contact point game, right? So all of a sudden that line drive is going to the backside because it's deep on him. If he gets his one flush, it's rising to the middle of the field, and if he's a little bit out in front, that ball's going to go really high to the pull side, and the swing functionality like within the evaluation is cool because all of a sudden you're watching guys and it's big hop ground ball. It's down left, right-handed hitter. It's big hop ground ball to the pull side, which is probably incorporating a little too much body and shoulders and spin, or he's flicking balls to the backside, high to the backside. And it becomes pretty easy to not be interested in that kid. You know what I'm saying? So I guess to answer your question, Patrick, I just think, man, does he hit low line drives to the backside, risers to the middle, and high to the pull side with backspin? If he does, that's a swing that I think we can really help and work with.
What was the theory on why the low line drives to the backside? Why did he like that?
Because so the contact point where you're striking that baseball is deeper on your body. And if you like, we talk about all the time, like we only have one swing and we have a B swing in terms of two strike, but less than two strikes, we have one club in the bag. And so anyway, that ball's traveling further. So now I'm striking it just like I would if I cut it out front, but really the only place for it to go is to shoot that way. And you're maintaining your barrel and dropping the head on that ball deep in the zone. And that's why it goes low. And then if you push it forward 6 inches or so, and now you're kind of striking it at your front foot. That ball, you're pretty in perfect rhythm to it. That ball's going dead center. And then if you're out front, like now you're kind of catching it on the upslope of your swing, and that's why it has a tendency to go really high.
I like that. I like that. What are some of the things that you guys emphasize to your players at Utah? Like if I'm a high school kid listening to this, maybe I want to play at Utah. I'm interested in playing at Utah. Like what from a development standpoint, I know everyone's a little bit different. I know Williams has had a ton of experience and there's, probably you guys are combining, what he's learned with some of the newer stuff, but it's, if we're being honest, it's kind of just the same thing, right? But it really is. But what are some things that you emphasize to the hitters on a daily basis, like your Utah as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, and the cool part about what Gwil has taught me and taught all of us is that's to summarize it. It's like if you can generate low line drives to the backside, high risers to the middle, and high to the pull side, your swing is functioning properly. You know what I mean? But I will say, Patrick, I mean, we want to drop head. We want to leverage the baseball. Like we want to hit high pull side homers. We want to be really, really aggressive. But what we don't want to be is we don't want to be body swingers. You know what I mean? We don't want to generate torque and be sort of secluded to one part of the plate, one speed, one pitch, and everything's got topspin and side spin. And that is generated. And you remember the chicken wing. I don't know if that's faux pas now, but like, man, kids coming in chicken wing swing, and there's just really no awareness of the barrel. So I think one thing, like we put a lot of weight on the barrel head, like we use penny bats pretty much every day to everything top loaded. So the minute that thing falls under your hands before you get ready to deliver a blow, you can't strike the baseball with any sort of authority or any consistency. And I think it's a challenge, man. I think kids can get comfortable in training environments where they know where the pitch is coming, there's really no extended ball flight, so they don't really see how much hook spin is being generated on the ball. And so it's a constant, it's a daily maintenance deal, and we got to see the ball fly. We use, to hit with one hand and two hands, and really try to backspin the baseball pretty much any direction of the field it's going, man. It's got to travel with backspin.
What about two strike approach? Do you guys have a thing where you try to everyone needs to change something, or is it individualized per player?
Yeah, there's a definitely a general scope to it. And I mean, I think for us, like with less than two strikes, we talk about being early or on time. Like we're trying to get the head out, we're trying to do damage. So our rhythm is early rhythm. With two strikes, I mean, again, we only have one swing, so we're not trying to carve balls out. We're not trying to push balls with two strikes. We're just trying to delay our rhythm. You know what I mean? We're trying to delay the decision to make a swing or not, which 80% of strikeouts in college baseball are from breaking balls underneath the strike zone. And if you look at our, which we actually did today as an offense, if you look at our striking out, it's the chase rate is way more than we'd like it to be. And that's because the rhythm is too early.
And that's on 80% breaking balls below.
That's what the root of all strikeouts are in college baseball. And the big leagues is almost, I think it's changed a little bit now, but that was also a pretty similar major league metric as well. It's chase. And so we're playing Oregon State this weekend, and they do a really, really good job of kind of flirting with that bottom of the strike zone. And then all of a sudden, when you think you're comfortable and you lose sight of delaying the heck out of that rhythm, the timing with two strikes, then you think it's going to be a strike and you swing, and the catcher turns his glove over. And it's another, you know, if you gave the kid the take sign, it's a ball. But I also think, too, man, we talk a lot about cowboying up. Like we want to spoil pitches. I think college pitchers, and I think all pitchers, man, they make mistakes. I think the average miss is like a 9 to 10 inch miss. And so anyway, I think the more we can talk about spoiling, competing, we say cowboy up because it's 8 pitches. As a bull rider, you're trying to stay on that thing for 8 seconds. I think as you have later rhythm and more of a spoil mentality, I think choking up on the bat is pretty important. Majority of our guys do. I think if a guy doesn't choke up, he's doing pretty well with two strikes, or maybe not getting to two strikes as often as some of the other guys. But in terms of cookie cutting guys, no, I mean, get grounded earlier, minimize a little bit of the trigger, but we really take pride in having one swing and being so in control of our barrels that we can kind of delay our rhythm and still, you know, foul off a fastball, still be late on a fastball.
What are the typical BP rounds?
One's a so a lot of execution. We have RBI rounds where we're kind of moving guys around the field on a daily basis. But the way that we look at the baseball is it's 1-2-3, right? We identify it as 1-2-3. The one side is the inside part of the baseball, the two is the back face, and the three is the outside of the baseball. So typically we're trying to hit ones in the middle with backspin. You know, and we'll slash, bunt, hit and run, and do some executional type situational stuff. But the majority of our rounds are, hey man, we're trying to hit. And then if you're early, it's going high to the pole side, and if you're late, it's going to the backside. And Patrick, I think I should back up. Like before, what I was talking about in terms of the low line drive to the backside, and I think this is, if you know Gwill, it's kind of common knowledge from. But we call that graduating. And so, like a lot of the stuff that you know, the BP rounds and the ones in the middle, and even before the situational stuff, like we're training our guys to really, really be able to drive that ball to the backside and have it roll to the fence is kind of the marker of success. And so, a lot of our BP may hit graduate round, and we'll just try to drill balls deep in the zone, high barrel, backspin them, and then open them up. And if it takes the club in the fall, generally, you know, the longer to achieve that piece of it, the graduation piece, then we're going to keep graduating until we can do it. Because I think that influences everything else. Now, all of a sudden, if you can hit a low line drive 8 feet high or lower, or 8 feet or down, and have that thing run to the fence, now you can play early. And everybody can, is not everybody, but it's a little easier to be early than have to dictate your late timing.
Yeah, I in terms of what you know exactly what Gwill teaches, like I'm 100% on board. Like I think I probably if he if we were together, I think we would be agreeing with pretty much everything. I one of the things that I do it seems like cookie cutting. Honestly, I say it so much is I just love, especially because I work with a lot of high school kids, is like we have to be able to hit a low line drive. Like I'm talking about a missile low line drive right at the second baseman that would go all the way to the wall. And so it's really, I mean, it sounds simple, but most kids really, they can't do it very well. They can't do it very well. And I don't know. It's something that, you know, what I always used to say to the kids is like, you got to earn your right to pull it, right? You got to earn your right. Like, you can't just go up there. It's so easy to just go up there and just pull the ball. Like, if you handed somebody a bat who's never swung in their life, they're naturally going to pull out. You know what I mean? So
Yes.
you have to have discipline to really focus on driving the ball to the opposite field. So I don't know. It gets me going on a rant
100%.
because it's something I think about all the time.
Well, and I think, and I mean, the more you think about it, the more, okay, 80% of strikeouts are on expanded breaking balls down because everybody's trying to go get it out there, and everybody has that inkling to go get that thing out front. You know what I mean? So again, our two-strike approach, and there's more specifics, but hey, graduate. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Let that ball travel, back the baseball up, and recognize the pitch as it's coming instead of out of the hand. And all of a sudden, everything enhances pretty, you know, in a pretty strong correlation.
What's the typical velo you guys are seeing?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, mid-90s. I mean, the starter that we're going to see, we think he's starting Friday, but he's 89 to 92. Oregon State's got a guy that throws at 95, 97. But I don't think that instantly makes him good. You know what I mean? I don't know if I should, but we faced a team this year who had a freshman kid throwing the daylights out of it. 94, 96, he could throw a ball 98. And going into the weekend, his opposing batting average was 500. And it was a really small sample size. And we faced, you know, like the velo is great, but the best pitchers in our league have a second pitch and they can command their fastball. You know what I mean? Like Merritt Jones is our Friday night guy. And when he commands his fastball and he commands his slider, he's 90 to 93, pitches more at 89 to 92, I think. But when he commands it, he's really good. And when he doesn't command it, it doesn't, you know, the velo is, it becomes irrelevant. So, but man, I would say it's upper 80s to low to mid 90s. I don't think it's, I don't, everybody's not throwing 94, 96, you know, which I hear that, you know.
Yeah, that's what you, I mean, if you were just on social media, you would believe that.
You would believe that, but you run out there and yeah. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. I think the harder throws, there's less margin for error. I think we got to be a little bit more specific in what we're trying to accomplish. But again, I think some of the hardest throwers that we've seen this season have not been the best arms we've seen by any stretch.
Interesting. Interesting. Mike, I wanted to talk a little bit about your playing background because I think it's pretty cool that you had a really good career in the SEC playing at University of Kentucky, but before then you were at a junior college playing junior college baseball. Take me through like a little bit of your own high school recruiting process. Like obviously, I'm sure in high school you weren't dreaming to go play in junior college, but clearly there was something there because you ended up playing in the SEC. So like why JUCO? Like kind of can you take me through your own recruiting process?
Well, and I went to Cal Poly out of high school,
Okay,
which
okay.
was a Division I in San Luis Obispo. And this is funny because this is so different from what it is. And you're familiar with Jerry Weinstein?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
So Jerry was the pitching coach. Larry Lee, who I love, mentor of mine today, he was the first, that was his first year at Poly. So he was the head coach at Cuesta College for, I think, like north of 15 years. Very successful. He gets the job at Cal Poly SLO. Jerry Weinstein's the pitching coach. I'm going to confuse some people. The year before Larry gets there. So Jerry is the pitching coach for Rich Price. I have a high school coach who him and Jerry were close. Mark Kenner is my high school coach's name, or the pitching coach. He's on his flip phone with Jerry Weinstein at the end of practice. And we're like raking. It's like, hey, Brownie, come here. Jerry wants to talk to you. And I had talked to him one time before, one time. And anyway, Jerry's like, hey, do you want to come to Cal Poly for books? And I'm like, hell yeah. And he's like, all right, cool. We'll mail you a packet. And then that was it. And I went home and I'm like, hey, I talked to Jerry Weinstein, like I'm going to Cal Poly. And my parents were like, oh, you know, so cool. Congratulations. And that was the process. So, and I don't even really remember this as a high school kid, but Richie takes the job at Kansas. So he goes to the University of Kansas. Larry Lee becomes the head coach. And I don't know if I talked to Larry at all, but I get there. I redshirt that year, which was one of the better years for me looking back, but I wasn't really ready to play at that level. I think that it took me a long time to believe that. But I just learned a lot. I saw college kids in action. I saw players kind of arguing with coaches, not in a, you know, disgruntled way, but like, hey, let's solve this issue kind of way. I got to learn from Coach Weinstein for, you know, for that season, which is a wealth of knowledge. But at the end of that year, Larry Lee, his vision was to have kids enrolled in Cal Poly go to the junior college and play. and then be able to come back to Cal Poly after 1 year, kind of a revolving door type deal. So I did that. I had a really nice year my freshman year, kind of, didn't anticipate that big of a year, that good of a year. Loved it, had a great time, loved the team. And so I didn't go back to Poly. And so then my recruiting process changed pretty good. I mean, Gary Henderson, who's my boss now, he recruited me out of Cuesta in 2005. So he was really close with Bob Miller, the Cuesta head coach. He came out and watched it and kind of shortened the process for me. I, got some calls, and I started to understand that, okay, there's recruiters and these coaches that are trying to find guys. Didn't know that at a high school, really. That wasn't on my radar. But Hendu came out and watched me play, watched me, supposed to watch me play in a doubleheader, got rained out, watched me hit BP in the rain and cages, take ground balls in a basketball gym. And I will say this, I think this is good, and this makes me feel a little weird saying it, but so they bring me out on a, they offer me a scholarship. They bring me out on a trip. I watch them play Georgia that they were, it was like, they're winning 10 to 4. They give up the lead 11 to 10, then they get the lead back and they gave it up again. I'll remember that. And then when I got back from the trip, they doubled my scholarship offer.
Doubled it.
And Hindu doubled it. And it wasn't very much, Patrick, don't get me wrong, in the beginning, but they doubled it. And they told me it was because they wanted my personality and my makeup on the team.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool for me. And then it was a, and maybe it was a great recruiting ploy, but I said yes. And but I never forget that, because I think about that all the time in recruiting kids. Like, it's about the personalities, and really what Coach Henderson wants on his club is a, he reminds me all the time, Brownie, it's about the personalities. Like, we need personalities. We need guys that are comfortable in their own skin. We need guys that appreciate stuff, appreciate their teammates, appreciate the opportunities, appreciate the resources that and I think that can be shown or come through in kids' personalities, especially when you're with them for a weekend, and you start to get a little bit more human touch with it.
Yeah, when you say personalities, do you mean like just good energy, like engaging? Like, is it a negative if a kid's just very, very quiet and doesn't just keep to himself?
Not at all.
No.
I think within that, I don't think you can have 35 super introverted, quiet kids. But a couple of our best players are, but I think personalities is can be kind of summarized in our world of, do they love playing the game? And when I say that, like, can they make mistakes and be themselves? Can they have success and be themselves? And can they be humble throughout the process? And you don't have to be loud and cheerleader or trash talker guy to execute those type of things. And I think too, you get some big personalities that demonstrate those, descriptions that I just said. And then all of a sudden the introverted quiet guy has a little bit more comfort to not be that quiet. You know what I'm saying? But I think those, the quiet guy or the guy who doesn't speak very much, I think those are all important, sort of recipes in this team, sort of, or ingredients in this team recipe that we're trying to put together. And it's shocking how often we have coaches have labeled a kid being quiet, introverted, then all of a sudden you see him around his teammates and he's not. You know what I mean? And so I just think the more comfort that each guy can have with his, with himself and within his own skin is kind of what I mean, generally speaking, by personality.
Okay, that makes sense. I like that. So you get to Kentucky. First of all, did you have any other offers besides Kentucky?
Yeah, so I Kansas, which is where Rich Price was now coaching. Kansas had offered me Riverside, UC Riverside had offered me Long Beach State. I canceled a trip to go to Long Beach State. Yeah, couldn't tell you the exact specifics, but there was other schools recruitment. I was the only, and this is also sort of makes me uncomfortable saying it, but kind of weird because in today's day, you know this, I was the only player in California Junior College that did not commit in the fall who hit 400. And a
Really?
teammate told me that, and it was like, okay, how did you know that? But so, my process wasn't flooded and it wasn't crazy, but if I didn't go to Kentucky, I feel like I could have went to a good place. I took an official visit to Kansas, took an official visit to Long Beach State, or to Riverside, canceled one to Long Beach State.
What was your experience playing in the SEC as a from a playing standpoint? Like, were you when you got there, coming from junior college, were you like, yeah, I can definitely play here? Or was it were you a little bit overwhelmed at first because of the hype of the SEC?
Well, great question. I mean, I felt like I could play there from the moment I got there, but I was maybe a little unrealistic. I didn't play that much my first year there. I was 7 for 29. Felt like my role was to be a great teammate and kind of energize the group. And we won the conference that year, first and only time Kentucky's ever won the league. But man, I think too, there was less hype about the SEC. There was less Twitter, there was less videos. The money and the resources that these schools had wasn't as public. But I mean, Vandy had David Price and Petey Alvarez and Mikey Minor going on the weekends, 220 year. So the quality, but I tell this to people all the time, like, it's not a flawless game. Like, you go to the SEC and you're going to watch a 19-year-old kid spray it around. And, if you're at A&M, they're going to count how many balls in a row you throw. And I don't think that just because it's the best conference in the country, no question, it doesn't eliminate all the baseball. You know what I mean? I mean, guys are giving up 4 or 5 run leads in the ninth. Even though they go to South Carolina or Florida or LSU, and it's an unbelievable level of baseball, but it's still baseball and it's still college kids, and they're still 18 to 20. Now it's 18 to 24, Patrick, which is weird. But you know what I'm saying? There's still kids trying to do well. And when that's the case, man, sometimes you don't.
Yeah, I get that question every once in a while. Like, are we still going to continue to see kids 24 years old playing college baseball?
I think so. I think the COVID stuff is behind us to some degree, but man, I just think kids are gap years, and I think kids are getting held back. I mean, we get like 19-year-old freshmen. So if you think about that, 19, now you're redshirt a year and you're a fifth year senior, legit 5 years of college, and you're 24.
Wow. Yeah,
So,
does that hurt them if they like do you take that into account their age, if they're held back or not? Because I know like from a professional standpoint, like obviously they're gonna know all that stuff, and younger is
and it hurts
definitely
them.
better. Do you care as much?
No. I think there's a lot of 23-year-old not mature kids. But generally speaking, you get a 23-year-old, like we got two grad transfers over the break, and they're great kids, but they're just more mature because they're like 23. And I think there's some immaturities in there. They're college kids. You wouldn't walk by them and be like, hey, that's a, but dealing with them, and they have experienced what the 21-year-old hasn't yet, or even what the 22-year-old hasn't yet, or what the 19 and 18-year-old for sure hasn't yet. And I think that is obviously that's life, you know what I mean? But I do think there's a value for us, especially in the world of 1 year deals. Hey man, this guy's gonna be with us for 1 year. He's 24. You can sort of assume that he's not gonna get into a bar fight or make too bad of a decision off of the field. But I do think it's funny because, like, what are your aspirations as a baseball player? But you start to graduate, or your draft year, your junior year, and you're 23 or 24. Like, that's not in the pro world, that's not positive.
No.
I've had guys say, hey man, if that kid was 2 years younger, he'd be a first rounder, and now he's gonna go undrafted. And you're like, damn, I don't know how true that is. But that's how kind of they view that side.
Wow, that's crazy. Well, Mike, I tell you what, man, this has been a ton of fun getting you on here. I can definitely tell what Coach Henderson was talking about. You got a great personality and really good energy. Really good energy about you. So I appreciate that. And thanks again for coming on today. It's crazy. We've already hit the 45-minute mark, but
Man.
I appreciate it, man. I'll be
Yeah,
looking
thanks for
forward. I'll
having
be
me.
following this weekend against Oregon State.
It'll be a fun week. I wish I was in the cage. You got a nice setup going, dude.
Yeah, appreciate it, man. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Patrick.